Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of GF Investment Services, LLC are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments based off of Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to my last show of 2013. This is Richard Martin of the Wake Up Call, and before we start, may I please make a request to those of you whose ISP is Gmail and who receive my regular emails. I have reason to believe that you may not be receiving my general emails, possibly due to Gmail holding them back under the impression that they are spam. Please let me know if you haven't received any emails over the last 3 or 4 days. Well, we're going to be together for 3 hours so that we can really take an in-depth look at what has happened this year, particularly in respect of the overwhelming majority of Americans who are actually worse off right now than they were a year ago. I hope you all had a wonderful Christmas. The real Christmas, you know, really isn't a measure of how much crap the shops can sell. It's truly a function of how well you can relate to a period where you can get together and just enjoy the simple pleasures of the people who surround you. Christmas is always a horrible moment for those who are alone and have nobody to share it with. There is no way of mitigating loneliness, and loneliness is probably most acute at holiday times such as Thanksgiving and Christmas. Not being American, Thanksgiving doesn't mean much to me, but I always think of Christmas as a tradition of togetherness passed on with just the vaguest of religious excuses to justify it. It's a pity that America gets so heated and defensive about what you're supposed to call the holiday period. In Malaysia, right here in this part of the world, for example, way less than 10% of the people are Christians, yet Christmas is the most widely celebrated holiday of the year, along with the Chinese New Year, and the Muslim Prime Minister always has a Christmas message and wishes everyone a Merry Christmas. I suppose that when you are so sure of yourself and your cultural underpinnings, you can say Merry Christmas with impunity. In America, you have to say Happy Holidays. Oh, well. So today, I'm going to break down my presentation into different topics, starting with the background and then investing, the bear case, the economy, broken markets, gold, debt and retirement, municipal debt, student debt, bonds and sovereign debt, housing and the mortgage markets, Europe, Cyprus and the rest of the world. Then we'll take a short break and I'll talk about confiscation, the Fourth Estate, CNBC, bankers and finance, the Federal Reserve, bootleggers, Paul Krugman, then what I call government gone wild, Obama, and then finally, last but definitely not least, civil liberties, with a particular emphasis on Edward Snowden, who really should have an airport named after him and, hey, perhaps even a state. What is it with this North and South, this and that anyway? Let's break up, North and South Dakota, call South Dakota Dakota, and North Dakota Snowden. It's far enough north that snow has some relevance, too. You know, killing two birds with one stone? A stupid expression if ever I heard one. I'll be talking a lot more about civil liberties in my January 3rd show, so we won't spend too much time on that. For those of you who are relatively new to the wake-up call, my purpose behind providing you with a twice-weekly window into my thinking is twofold. Firstly, I want to educate you in concepts that I think you should know and that the mainstream media patently does not want to insist on. For example, they don't really want you to know that there is a heightened chance that the stock market will collapse at some point in the near future. I say that not because I have any superior knowledge of these things, but because this is what we've historically seen. Great panic-style run-ups and enormous gains over a short period of time are always followed by brutal retracement. Always. If for some reason it should not happen this time, it would be a first. It will happen, ladies and gentlemen. So some of the terms and concepts may seem arcane and complicated, but I assure you they are useful to your overall understanding of the issues. So far as investing is concerned, up to now, I have been somewhat wrong on the stock market, but very right on almost everything else. I saw the fall in gold, the maintenance of the value of the dollar, the deflationary collapse of commodity prices, and the no recovery recovery. The stock market is my Achilles heel, and I believe it will make a spectacular and definitive decline very soon. We will come back to this over the course of the next few hours. I have emphasized the holding of treasury bills as the best and safest weapon against any and all adverse eventualities. To say I am pissed off at the Fed for rendering people's hard-earned and diligently saved capital worthless in the open markets because they are providing capital in unlimited quantities would be a grotesque understatement. I couldn't care less what risky horse meat Bernanke wishes people would buy. More people have been slaughtered reaching for yield than at the point of a gun. Many of you will have heard me make frequent reference to David Stockman's new book, The Great Deformation. It is, in my opinion, the definitive economic book of 2013 and a must read. Stockman's thesis is that the global capital markets have been infected by horrendous monetary policies. You cannot come away from reading this book without a sense of foreboding, the sense that something is lurking below the placid surface. So let's look at what we really have to worry about over the future. The unemployment will fall. 10% hike is the aging that is. What in man's 20-year-old lost decade is often attributed to inadequate intervention by central bankers and policymakers insufficiently armed with untested theories of academic economists mired in state capitalism. But the reality, the simple reality, is that the Japanese have also been getting old. I have seen estimates that Japan will demographically bottom out with one worker for every three retirees. You can fiddle with dollars, cents, yen, GDP, Japanese government bonds and savings estimates all you want, but the demonetized reality is that Japan will have one worker providing all the goods and services for four people. Kyle Bass is right. The Japanese economy is rotting from within. The way in which that affects Americans is by way of extrapolation. America is a decade or two behind Japan, but making up ground fast. Its politicians have promised boomers a huge package of benefits in their old age. Economists such as Kotlikoff, Burns, and Smelters, in cahoots with Secretary of the Treasury Paul O'Neill, set out to wrap their brains around these unfunded liabilities. Now remember, ladies and gentlemen, and understand this well, these are promises by ignorant politicians pandering for votes who absolutely have no idea. They have no clue whatsoever. After subtracting reasonable estimates of revenue streams, they have not the faintest idea how they will cover these liabilities. Kotlikoff now estimates that these liabilities total $205 trillion. Some of you have heard this number, I've mentioned it before, but precious few can grasp it. $205 trillion. Let me try to deconstruct that for you. Assuming that there are 100 million taxpayers to pick up this tab, and that the average taxpayer contributes 25% of his or her $50,000 a year salary, a preposterous payment schedule and an absurd concept to start with, it will take 160 years, two lifetimes. Now let's talk a bit about the economy. As I wrote the other day in an email to my subscriber group, corporate balance sheets are said to be in unbelievable shape. But what the analysts conveniently forget to tell you, corporate debt is all-time high. Yes, there's 2000 worse than 2007. We are also told with considerable glee that corporate profit margins are breaking all-time records, possibly up to 70% above the historical averages. This, unfortunately, is very bad news because profit margins are notoriously mean regressing. I'm talking about a 70% mean regression. Now picture the inevitable downside overshoot, which must obviously happen, or the 70% wouldn't be the mean. Profit margins are propped up by cheap capital, courtesy of the Fed, lower numbers of employed workers, euphemistically called increased efficiency, savings from increased numbers of benefit-free part-time workers, and less wage pressure by the employees. Corporate capital expenditure is zero. I was struck by it faces pressure from generic drug companies. Their response? Buy back shares. Corporate profit margins will naturally shrink. If the Fed gets its way and workers begin to enforce some wage inflation into the equation, the regression of profit margins through the mean could be dramatic. The margins will collapse. The fruits of research and development will cease to exist. So now let's look at the employment situation. Statistics on employment numbers will be less. Email recipients, and it certainly shows a ghastly picture. The labor participation rate is deceptive in that it suggests we were at this level pre-1980, and life seemingly just goes on. However, any further drop begins to dig into the gains made by women entering the workforce in droves. That distant era only worked well because men were paid enough to raise a family on a single income. Most had full-time rather than part-time employment, and college grads were doing jobs requiring name tags. Boomers exiting the workforce en masse are just beginning to add to this already intolerable picture this year. Of course, we're assured they will work till they drop or are released in a corporate downsizing to increase productivity. The raw employment data are staggering. Grant Williams, for example, has noted that the heralded 260,000 job gain reported in 1 month included over 400,000 part-time jobs, which, as you know, are jobs without benefits. Although the headlines report job growth, the economy actually lost 276,000 full-time jobs, jobs with benefits. An estimated 77% of new jobs are part-time. Only 47% of adults have full-time jobs. An estimated 100 million working-age people are not working. 100 million, ladies and gentlemen. As we row this boat of an economy through turbulent seas, only half the crew are pulling on the oars. So now let's turn our attention to household stress. Median household income in the United States has fallen for 4 consecutive years. Over 50% of all American workers now make less than $30,000 a year. 40% of all workers in the United States make less than what a full-time minimum wage worker made back in 1968. A record and monumental 50 million people are on food stamps. Walmart leaked a story of decaying fundamentals. The Walmart executive who leaked the info decided to spend time at the unemployment office. Watch the malls. Many are using the Potemkin Village ploy, putting in unstaffed fake stores, such as the Garden Tractor Store, just for show. As Arnold Schwarzenegger is deemed to have said, "Money doesn't make you happy. I now have $50 million, but I was just as happy when I had $48 million." When it comes to wealth disparity, there are seemingly as many ways of measuring this as there are people who do the measuring. The income growth at the top end of the earnings curve has soared by comparison, eliciting the 1%, 99% nomenclature. The net worth at the top has also soared, whereas the net worth changes from plus to minus in the bottom deciles. Sales of high-end collectibles, such as impressionist paintings, that I think are grotesquely overrated and certainly oversupplied, are busting records at Sotheby's and Christie's. Prices are not being driven by the builders of empires, Dell, Gates, Ellison, but by guys who are moving money for a living. This is what Kevin Phillips called financialization of an economy, the most prominent hallmark of empires about to exit through a non-revolving door. There is an interesting conundrum which comes up for me at this point. We know from the 1920s economist Joseph Schumpeter that there is an element of creative destruction built into everything we do, including manufactured goods. Obviously, replacing the dilapidated and inefficient old with new and improved variants, the epitome of creative destruction, is capitalism at its finest. Nobody will scream louder than buggy whip makers caught in the path of creative forces involved in the manufacture of cars, but those screams do and should fall on deaf ears. There is a point, however, at which the hyperactive replacement cycle of durable goods becomes what we call malinvestment, non-productive or wasteful investment. For example, how would it work out for you if you bulldozed your house every 10 years and replaced it with a better one? The replacement cycle in our economy today in general is certainly cycling too fast. Aggressive monetary policy fostering an economy that is flailing is responsible for this. And very simply put, We are trying to increase our standard of living artificially, doubtless with the best of intentions, but at an unsustainable rate. By unsustainable, I mean we cannot afford to take on so much debt to achieve this. We can achieve this, but at a much slower rate. Now, because we have gone too far too fast, we will have to take the consequences. And, as we shall see, the consequences will be very grave. Well, the end of the show hopefully will provide an opportunity to provide a criticism of Bernanke or me, preferably in that order, and air whatever other thought opinions you may hold. And I hope that in the final hour of this presentation you will feel disposed to fire up a discussion in which four people can be online at the same time. So, let's see what happens. And you can also email me at your leisure. My email page is open at all times, so I can hopefully address yours during the same show if you get it in early enough. So the toll-free number that you might want to call at some point later in the show is 888-874-4888. And my email address is rm@gfawd.com. That's RM for Richard Martin at gfawd.com for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design. And if you'd like to call me in private, you may do so at 941-441-1682. That's my local U.S. phone number. Come straight through to me in Southeast Asia. Again, 941-441-1682. And by the way, the Richard Martin Meetup Group will be meeting again on Sunday, January the 27th at 2:30 p.m., and Adrian, our moderator, is always on hand to take your calls for more information, and his number is 973-868-1433. Actually, it's 973, I apologize. 973-868-1433. Okay, so now let's move on and have a look at the markets. Are they overpriced, underpriced, or correctly priced? Who's to say that markets are under or overpriced? The price is the price, right? Well, two New York Federal Reserve economists just delivered a paper concluding that U.S. stocks are as cheap today as at any time in history, which is a little odd given that they were 60% cheaper in March 2009. Now, I guess that's just a small detail conveniently overlooked by the shills at the Fed. Although the world equity markets have been rising, GDP has simultaneously been looking a little green around the gills, as I have not hesitated to point out at every opportunity. Let's focus on the U.S. forward-looking earnings, which are said to appear reasonable. Of course, these so-called earnings do not exist except in the minds of optimistic analysts. By contrast, the Case-Shiller PE using time-averaged earnings is in the scary 24 zone. For comparison's sake, remember that an averagely valued market will have a PE ratio of about 15, and the PE ratio at the time of the crash of 1929, for reference sake, was only 21. John Hussman, a brilliant analyst who I follow each week, suggests bear market bottoms occur at a Case-Shiller PE of about 8. The S&P price-revenue ratio of 1.6 is twice its pre-bubble historical norm of about 0.8. The 1987 peak occurred at a price-revenue ratio of less than 1. The Russell 2000 is now sporting a PE of 40, using 2014 fabricated earnings, but a PE of 60 times the realistic trailing earnings. David Stockman says that by excluding charges, so-called X items, companies fabricate an additional 30% to the earnings numbers. You can find distortions of comparable magnitude by using the forward earnings that are invariably way too optimistic. As the forward earnings become discredited by reality, analysts quickly switch to forward earnings. There are smart analysts questioning whether price discovery is even working at all. Jeremy Grantham, the wise old man with $150 billion under management, puts fair market value on the S&P 70% below current levels. Coincidentally, the same percentile as the bloated profit margins. Cliff Asness, looking across all markets, concludes that the 60-40 portfolio has been cheaper than it is now 98% of the time. David Einhorn notes that, quote, the S&P 500 index has advanced this year mostly through multiple expansion, end of quote. The gains of 2012 were all multiple expansion as well. Are the distortions attributable to X items and forward earnings additive? I don't know, but Peter Buchvar summed it up nicely, quote unquote, there is 0% chance this ends well. Ladies and gentlemen, the news here is very grim indeed. We've created another equity bubble. There are certainly links to the global central bankers' massive monetary infusions. Add Mentos to Coke and shake vigorously. Margin debt is soaring. I've had arguments about whether the tracking of margin debt with equity prices is causation or merely correlation. I actually don't care. If both correlate with groundhogs popping their heads up, I'm keeping both eyes on the groundhogs. And by the way, if you're interested in the contrarian theory of market behavior, which has it that the least number of people thinking something will probably coincide with that very thing happening, the number of equity bears just hit a greater than 25-year low, probably much greater than 25 years. When career risk forces managers to buy an asset class, it's time to sell that asset class. Career risk means that fund managers only buy something because everyone else is, and they can't afford to risk their jobs by not holding that particular investment at the end of any particular quarter. Are we there yet? Jeremy Siegel, the indefatigable optimist, thinks earnings are being underestimated. Yes, you heard that right, making the market only appear expensive. Ladies and gentlemen, you decide. Oh yes, we do indeed have a major stock market bubble on our hands, the third in 13 years. David Einhorn suggests that, quote, when high short interest becomes a viable stock-picking strategy and conventional valuation methods no longer apply for many stocks, we can't help but feeling a sense of déjà vu, end of quote. Of course, he was probably thinking of Green Mountain Coffee, which is an Einhorn short and is up 100% this year and 200% off its 2012 lows. Einhorn knows where the bodies are buried. This is a classic squeeze of traders who follow his lead but lack his patience. Other stocks that popped up include Tesla, Best Buy, and Fannie Mae. Those are year-to-date. Tesla's market cap is $20 billion, and the number of cars sold, 35,000 a year, corresponds to more than $500,000 per car. Netflix is now sporting a PE of 200, causing value investors to wince and momentum traders to just keep on clicking. American.com shares are up 60% since 2011, whereas their revenues have fallen 50% over that time period. Well, ladies and gentlemen, the star performer was Bitcoin, everybody's favorite virtual currency, starting the year at $13 per Bitcoin, and then it ran and ran and ran. A return of 100% in 15 minutes was upstaged by a 100-fold jump in the first 10 months of 2013, at which point profit-taking looked like it would cause Bitcoin to hurtle back to Middle Earth. 65-fold as of 10 minutes ago. We are watching history being made, or history being repeated. Although I endorse what Bitcoin represents, opposition to fiat currency, its success is not assured. Last year we had some stellar market glitches. Although Facebook got the press, the complete annihilation of bats and night trading brought the comedic flair of the year. This year was tame, but daily flash crashes and glitches documented by Eric Hunsader and others at the research firm Nanex became truly ominous. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I think at this point we will take a break, and I'll be right back. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, well, as far as gold is concerned, I'm not going to say much, except that I was, as most of you know, bearish throughout 2013 and 2012, if it comes to that, on the price of gold, and seeing how it rally if people don't have the money to buy an asset is clearly destined, unlike stocks, for a permanent position in their portfolios. Deflation reigns, and whether you like it or not, assets of all kinds have a tendency to fall in price during periods of deflation. This is not a helpful piece of news to the myriad of gold trading companies who can only make a decent living for themselves if the price of gold goes up, and they comment accordingly. The Germans want their gold out of the United States, and the Americans have told them they'll have to wait 7 years. No prizes for correctly guessing what that means. Now, I think we should address the overwhelming problems of what to do about people who are too old to work and have to stop. It's called retirement, and apart from blindness, it is my most overriding fear, the need, not the desire, to retire. I personally cannot imagine retiring. I have no desire whatsoever to retire. I don't just work to make money. I realize I'm very lucky. I work because I enjoy what I do, and I simply cannot imagine a day when I'm incapacitated by age, whatever that may mean, from continuing to work. I can't imagine how it happens. You sort of wake up one day unable to get out of bed and saying to your significant other, "Honey, I can't get up. I'll have to stop working." Do you simply become too forgetful to be able to coexist with others in the job market? Do you become physically too weak to make it to your workplace? I don't know how it happens, and frankly, I don't think I want to find out. But inevitably, it does happen. They should add retirement to one of life's certainties, like death and taxes. Anyway, the point of all this is that everyone who makes it that far eventually retires. So I want to look at this through the prism of money and how much of it we have at retirement and how we get there and whether the system will support us in the event of shortfalls. So let's start by taking a giant step back and look at a couple of definitions. Savings, deferred consumption. Debt, consumption from the future pulled to the present or past. Let me repeat that. Savings can be seen as deferred consumption and debt as consumption from the future pulled to the present or the past. So these definitions of savings and debt will keep you from being tangled up in dollars and cents. If you pull consumption forward, you'll eventually have to go without later. A baby born with absolutely nothing to its name is better off than 25% of adult Americans who are in net debt. That holds steady until young adulthood, when student debt gets a grip on so many. We talk about student debt separately later on, seeing how complex and important it is. The US and arguably the rest of the developed world are in massive trouble owing to what many call a debt supercycle, a global debt problem of monumental proportions. And yes, there really is such a thing as a global debt problem. To the extent that you can neither stockpile goods and services, the entire world is on the pay-as-you-go or pay-go system. I don't care who has what drawer full of IOUs claiming somebody owes them money. A global demographic problem is a global debt problem. I describe a global debt problem as the misalignment of perception and reality, and I still find this approach most compelling. If everybody goes on thinking they can continue to live indefinitely at a level above production capacity, you have a global debt problem. In dollar currency terms, if you are aware of what has been promised to you, yet unaware of what your costs will be to service promises to others, you have a debt problem. Everybody knows what their pension is worth, but I very much doubt that the average taxpayer realizes that he or she each owes $30,000 to top off existing municipal pension funds. I am quite sure the average taxpayer fails to realize that his or her share of the total unfunded liabilities is $2 million. They have a debt problem. If you are owed goods and services by people who haven't a clue how they will pay up, a form of counterparty risk, their debt problem is now your debt problem. It is blindingly simple, ladies and gentlemen. You can't have the American dream if you can't crank out adequate goods and services to do so. As Simon Black says in his Sovereign Man blog, America's debt challenge is not a political problem, it's an arithmetic problem. Let's look at some specifics. I blur the lines between debt and lack of savings according to the logic that both involve misaligned expectations and reality. The guy with the $154,000 annual salary and $1.2 million of accrued wealth is likely to be a baby boomer. According to the time-tested rule of 4% withdrawal in retirement to minimize risk of running out, this guy could pull out only $45,000 a year. A more recent estimate by Stephen Roach puts this guy's financial assets at only $550,000. There are many ways to suffer at this income level, even supplemented by Social Security. Recent studies have noted that financial repression is inflicted on us by the Federal Reserve, dropping fixed income returns to precisely squat, render 4% much too aggressive. Even a 3% withdrawal rate is said to leave a 30% chance of running out of money before you take your last breath, which, by the way, should come within a month after running out of food. At 3% withdrawal and Roach's estimates, Mr. 5 percentile guy just slipped below the pay scale of the lowest paid commuter pilot, around $20,000. But it's worse than that. The putative well-off are already in trouble. We have increasing numbers of doctors declaring bankruptcy. As described in the excellent book, The Millionaire Next Door, doctors are the worst savers, but bankruptcy? What about the average bloke? A typical worker near retirement has less than 2 years of replacement income saved, with median estimates of 70,000 retirement savings for 55-year-olds. Using the rickety 4% rule, $70,000 will spin off the princely sum of $2,800 a year. Estimates state that 41% of 65 to 74-year-olds actually living in their own house still have mortgages, and the median balance within that group is $97,000 for pre-retirees and $70,000 for retirees. As I explained a couple of days ago in Friday's show, a huge number of home equity lines of credit are about to reset to higher rates. A lot of retirees will be caught by that. More than 30% of 45 to 55-year-olds have saved nothing for retirement. The median retirement account across all age brackets is estimated at $3,000. The boomers aren't such an aberration. Any notion we will grow our way out of this problem is suspect in light of median wages, which have shrunk in the last 5 years and are said to have largely stagnated, when inflation adjusted in the case of production workers for several decades. 60% of workers accumulated more debt than they contributed to retirement savings between 2010 and 2011. One-fifth of 401k account holders have a loan against their accounts. Frontline's The Retirement Gamble is Worth a Peek. Ted Benner, the father of the 401k itself, is horrified at his own creation. This is a catastrophic state of affairs. It seems unlikely that the spiking price of Netflix or a Twitter IPO will save us. Austerity is not a policy. It is a consequence of bad policy. So let me offer three random bits of advice to the young. One, save more and spend less. You will have more and need less. Two, stop buying cigarettes and lotto tickets at the convenience store. Three, read The Millionaire Next Door in your early 20s. I know of someone from China who has been in the U.S. for a dozen years and just become a naturalized U.S. citizen. I know what she's paid. Her husband maintains an independent apartment working in Chicago. She's paid off a huge percentage of her house, maxed out her retirement account, and put her son through an Ivy League university without taking on a penny of debt. She shames us all. All right, let's look at a few other items of debt within the system. Let's start with municipal debt. I've spoken quite a lot about this in recent shows, so regular listeners should be fairly up to speed on this one. Remember Barack Obama's comment, "I refuse to let Detroit go bankrupt"? Obviously, the Chapter 9 debt filing by Detroit was this year's big news. After years of a non-revitalizing economy, the entire city simply fell into its own foundation. Try and watch some videos with various Detroit ghetto title. I find one photo montage capturing Detroit's previous splendor in total ruin to be particularly disturbing. I put it out to my email group earlier this year. A judge tried to stop the bankruptcy, but no judicial fiat could change reality. They're out of cash and $20 billion in the hole. Ironically, the presiding judge is an expert on Ponzi schemes. A Michigan bond deal went fully unsubscribed. You've got to imagine Detroit played a role in that. Detroit's plight was inevitable, but it was to be an uphill battle until the end. The pension costs get a lot of credit, but they are only 5% of the budget. The fees paid to the financial system on the general obligation bonds used to top off the pensions, however, may have been oppressive. Some suggest that Detroit failed to adjust in real time, causing them to hit the bridge abutment at full throttle. Failure to curb waste and make mid-course corrections in any economy is bad, and it's happening everywhere. So what is Detroit planning as all seems lost? A toga party? No. Building a taxpayer-funded sports arena. Well, the economics of such projects have been discredited by multiple analyses. I would enthusiastically support federal funds to pay local blue-collar workers to bulldoze dozens of square miles of abandoned buildings. I could imagine green sprouts emerging over time, but not from total wreckage. On the very day that Beirut on the Lake went belly up, the Dow hit all-time highs. The muni bond market, by contrast, got the bejesus scared out of it with good cause. Illinois, for example, seems to have some serious problems with a pension fund that is only 40% funded, $53 billion in the hole and still digging. An Illinois public relations man fought back against Zero Hedge's assertion that the pension is in big trouble. That was Baghdad Bob talking, because their pension guru said that the, quote, Illinois teachers' retirement system cannot invest its way out of the funding hole we are in, end of quote. Illinois had a debt sale that went south and was promptly delayed, prompting Kate Long, a prolific writer on municipal debt, to note wryly that, quote unquote, something went very wrong. Cook County is $140 million in the hole. Is that big? I don't know. The state is $305 billion in the hole, $30,000 per taxpayer. That's big. Meanwhile, one in six Illinoisans are on food stamps. Other states are not far behind. Only eight states have budget surpluses. California has state and local governments that are in the hole for over $1 trillion, $26,000 per capita. CalPERS, the California retirement system, is having trouble collecting pension payments from the municipalities. It's not surprising, given bankruptcies in Vallejo, San Bernardino, Mammoth Lakes, Stockton, probably just to name a few, as they say. The overall municipal market showed serious stress by June of last year. Puerto Rico's problems led to a 20% bond collapse in a single month, posing the question of how far our concerns should reach. Given that QE has been bailing out all of Europe, it seems that question has been answered. Many of the wounds were self-inflicted, with Wall Street supplying the weapon. A number of states are suffering because they sold bonds against their revenues from the tobacco settlement, only to watch the tobacco revenues tail off with abstinence. Stockton was guided into bankruptcy by some ill-conceived pension obligation bonds that went bad. Jefferson County won billions in a settlement related to scams against it, and that was certainly not enough. Denver is spending over 60% of its school budget to unwind ill-advised derivative trades. Miami-Dade County's $91 million loan to build the Marlins a new stadium. Yes, that's right, another of these damned stadiums. And that cost them an additional $1.2 billion in fees. Maybe some of the Marlins players can IPO themselves to help pick up the tab. Watch out for forthcoming privatizations, Chicago style. It all makes you wonder whether some of the mayors are smoking crack. So now let's turn to the other huge debt boondoggle that will have to be addressed very soon, student debt. But before we go on, let's just familiarize ourselves with two of the famous sayings from the famous wise oracle Ben Shalom Bernanke. The first was graciously handed down to us in 2007. The subprime mess is grave but largely contained. How nice. The next pair of wisdom from none other than the same orator was issued just this year in 2013. The amount of student debt is large but not particularly likely to cause macroeconomic instability. Well, thank you for those utterances, Mr. B. You sure do know your way out of the proverbial paper bag, do you not? The student debt problem is often presented in simple terms. Unlimited credit allows banks to saddle mentally impaired consumers, otherwise known as 18-year-olds, with non-dischargeable loans at usurious rates to pay soaring tuition bills stemming from gold-plated amenities and overpaid faculty, all of which have come about because colleges can charge anything they want. There are shards of truth in there, but the story is a little more nuanced. Let's first look at the problem, which is undeniable. Student debt has soared to over $1 trillion, causing many to declare it the next bubble. Last year, it seemed to many that stringent legal protections of even the most usurious lenders would preclude the popping phase. Apparently, the students didn't listen. The bubble is popping right now. 7 million student loans are in default, ladies and gentlemen. 50% of all loans are in forbearance or deferment. You cannot squeeze blood out of a stone. Parents who had the stones to co-sign are another story. Student debt, that at one time appeared to be a highly protected asset class, is increasingly becoming subprime and defaulting. Sallie Mae was forced to cancel debt offerings. The proper popular Stafford loans are about to see their interest rates double from 3.4 to 6.8%. That's really going to hurt. I can't tell you how this is going to play out. Right now, it's simply a monumental mess. What I can say with certainty is that student debt is almost guaranteed to hobble a generation and the American economy for years. Think of the wasted intellectual energy to society of what Bloomberg called indentured students, who had the potential to change the world, but instead will be forced to plant themselves in a cubicle to get three square meals, a roof, and a monthly loan payment. Generation hosed is justifiably infuriated. Imagine watching brokerage ads touting ages 25 to 35 as critically formative saving years while sitting on a huge pile of student debt, accruing penalties, and sitting on your parents' couch, doubling as a bed. They were told to get a degree and a job. One out of two is bad. Tuition costs are undeniably rising above inflation, but for the moment, there is no hemorrhage. In 1980, in the average private university, everything that had direct comparison with the present was supported at a higher level. The staffing levels, a huge percentage of the cost, were higher. The number of teaching assistants was larger. There is no simple answer. I imagined that in a winner-take-all system, that the highest-paid faculty had elongated the pay scale. That didn't happen. Salaries at the top of the faculties, as compared with those of starting assistant professors, reveals a proportionality that has not budged since 1980. Moreover, faculty salaries have slipped when compared with graduate student stipends. I suspect that the bloat has appeared in middle management and administrative staff. What is difficult to fathom by those outside the system, however, is the enormous complexity of running an institution that is tied in every respect to state and federal government. Compliance with federal and social responsibilities has grown, a form of unfunded mandates. Think about the changes that have occurred in the typical doctor's office. The same thing has happened at universities as well. I suspect universities could do better, but it is a battle. They talk a lot about luxurious facilities. Indeed, they are constantly improving relative to the olden days. There is an arms race to get the best students. But buildings and dorms are frequently funded from private donations and government sources, not tuition. For example, recent construction at Cornell has been paid for by Seth Klarman, Sandy Weill, and Bill and Melinda Gates. Chuck Feeney of Duty Free Shops fame has donated almost $1 billion to Cornell, including the money to build the new dorms that supposedly drive up the cost of housing. Money flooding in from wealthy alumni goes to mitigate the costs of education. The costs of running a university are much higher than the tuition costs collected. All right, ladies and gentlemen, let us take another break, and I will be right back. Look, I don't have solutions to the existing problem, but I do have a few suggestions for those of you who may be considering higher education right now. One, don't go to an expensive college when a cheap one will suffice. Some of the state schools are spectacular, although they are getting more expensive. Two, if you are a parent, help your kids think about their majors. Some subjects should be minors. 3. Start cheaply and transfer into the elite schools. 4. Some of you should delay entering a college or taking time off after entering school to sharpen your focus. Parents are often the biggest obstacles to such a plan. 5. Skip college if you're just going to screw around. It is an expensive way to learn keg stand skills. 6. Payment systems should be developed based on percentage of income for a set number of years after graduation to protect students from impossible payment schemes and incentivize schools to produce a profitable education. 7. Don't count on the massive open online courses to save you. The maturity required to excel without the cloistering of the campus life is rare. Massive open online courses could be part of the solution, but only part. 8. Wealthy donors might consider supporting renovations of existing structures rather than new buildings. It's a much harder sell for administrators. Everybody says we need more college graduates. That's a total crock. We need a more skilled populace. For some, education provides the needed skills. Others should find the skills elsewhere. All right, let's have a quick look at bonds. Bonds, and by proxy, sovereign debt, almost became the story of the year when the Fed threatened to taper QE. Interest rates rose sharply, the stock market started to fall, and the Fed backed away from its threat. After 30 years of a bull market in bonds, everyone is utterly convinced that bonds are now about to collapse. This is most unusual sentiment for a market top, especially one of such long duration. That is one powerful reason why I believe the much vaunted turn may not happen. Foreigners are selling bonds. Brokerages are hiding from them, issuing warnings to their customers to lighten up or at least shorten up the duration to about 15 minutes. The reach for yield is going other places. In February, UBS warned its clients to lighten up. Bank of America warned of a bond crash. HSBC warned of the great liquidity drought. Mohammed El Arian of PIMCO asked rhetorically, why is it that the PIMCOs of this world are not disciplining in a system that is becoming more and more artificial? Why do we allow the manipulation? Are we sure it's a bubble? Not necessarily. Rwanda's 10-year debt dropped below 6%. Rwanda? The U.S. junk bond market has hit a record $2 trillion. Barclays says that, quote, the U.S. high yield index fell to a record low 4.9%, the first time it has ever fallen below 5%, unquote. Apple, with its enormous cash balance, a real cash balance in excess of $100 billion, sold 30-year debt, turning itself into combination tech company and leveraged hedge fund. Let me wrap my brain around this. A tech company selling 30-year debt? Tech companies should avoid buying green bananas for their cafeteria. Oddly enough, Apple's share price almost immediately started its downward slide, and the Apple bonds are already underwater, having lost 9% of their principal in 1 week. So yes, everybody has decided it's a bubble. Rates were this low in the post-World War II disinflationary period. But here is where people cannot get to grips with reality. We are yet again in a disinflationary period. No, people won't have it. This is inflation, they say, leading, who knows, to hyperinflation. Why? I cannot get a coherent answer from anyone to that question. Still, people say things like, the irony is that the low yields or high prices are manifestations of inflation incited by the Feds, or what a Rabobank analyst called the Great Flotation. The argument then has it that even if central banks can keep it up for a while, maybe even a long while, the day will come when the Fed will be forced to taper, which is true. Someday, the bond market will roll over with a gigantic groan because the huge chunk of debt normalized to GDP is top-heavy. The downturn we are currently experiencing is largely mortgage defaults. There is no real deleveraging. Jim Rogers notes accurately that a 1% rise on the 10-year bond shaves 9% off the principal. Jim Rickards is predicting that rising rates will cut portfolio of bonds in half. The 1987 crash was preceded by rising rates that went unheeded by risk seekers. Equity investors are likely to find the risk they are always professing to seek. True, 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 and true. But what people fail to recognize is that there's a world of difference between corporate bonds and government bonds. When the stock market collapses, people do not fly for safety into corporate bonds. They take refuge in government treasury bonds. The pundits are making the fateful mistake of confusing corporate with government debt. The bull market in government bonds is by no means over. And that's where I concentrate my attentions when the stock market finally decides to collapse. Low interest rates have been supporting marginally profitable enterprises. I've already noted that corporate profit margins supported by low borrowing costs are at record highs. They will regress to the mean and the PE ratios will follow. Many marginal enterprises will become unprofitable. We will have the epiphany to end all epiphanies. The Fed doesn't have a clue what it's doing. It will get a true and horrible lesson in the meaning of malinvestment. The bubble will leave investors prostrate before the secular bear market is over. And it won't be our children and grandchildren who feel the effects first. That meme trivializes the risk because we obviously don't give a hoot about them. It will be us. And it will be a generational lesson. So now let's turn our attention to the housing and mortgage markets. You could be forgiven if you were confused by the housing markets. We are being told by waves of pundits that housing is in full recovery mode. How could this be? Didn't they just build more houses than the system could possibly absorb? Didn't Greenspan convince homeowners to withdraw equity from their houses, only to find out that they lived in the same house but owed twice as much? Are we generating yet another bubble? Well, yes and no. We have a huge credit bubble, but not a new housing bubble, only the aftermath of a deflating old one. The double-digit percentage growth in new housing starts is said to be the, quote, largest surge in home sales since 1980, unquote. It's feeble at best. $1 trillion per year of Fed stimulus bought the country fewer housing starts than in 1964. There are indeed new buyers coming into the market, but many would-be new buyers are unemployed 20-somethings living in the basements of their parents' houses. Houses that have a 22% probability of being funded themselves by an underwater mortgage. An estimated 11 million mortgages are underwater, ladies and gentlemen. The plot thickens when you find that up to 60% of new buyers of single-family homes are paying with cash. This wave of buyers consists of private equity firms, hedge funds, and big banks leveraging up, using Fed largesse to buy billions of dollars worth of single-family homes. It's not cash. They're securitizing the houses to market rent-backed bonds and rental REITs, that's real estate investment trusts. Maybe these are the first buyers, the vanguard, who appear at the bottom of any distressed market. But then, again, maybe not. Many renters, formerly unsuited homeowners, should definitely remain renters. And here's where the plot line turns dark. Single-family home rentals are notoriously lousy businesses. Ask any homeowner. There are already reports of renters being unable to get in touch with the absentee landlords. Wall Street often places huge bets on lousy businesses. They are the new flippers. Recent entrants include JP Morgan, Deutsche Bank, and Blackstone. New companies with catchy names like American Homes 4, that's number 4 rent, are announcing IPOs. You'll be seeing a lot of post-IPO charts like that of Silver Bay Realty Trust Corp and American Residential Properties. Goldman traders supposedly referred to these two companies as, quote, straight to the Muppet dump. It will be much like the mortgage craze of a decade ago, except the appreciation part. The honeymoon period for investors will be, or may have been, very short-lived. Schiller thinks this is a new mania in which the Wall Street is just chasing momentum, but what does he know? Regardless, a new wave of securities is coming to a pension fund near you. Cover your faces because they are about to get ripped off as these funds fail to find renters to save their jobs. And they will not be able to service the cost of their recent acquisitions. They turn round and fling these investments back onto the market. It's going to happen. And the housing market will collapse way under its 2007-2008 levels. All right, now let's have a quick look at Europe. Europe has been tribal for millennia. It is the exceptional moment when a bar fight isn't breaking out somewhere on the continent. Fighting stops when they run out of resources. Many factors for renewed European conflict are squarely in place. Leader of the UK Independent Party, Nigel Farage, is betting on what he calls violent revolution across Europe. I'm sure others share his view, if not his penchant for unmitigated prose. Unbeknownst to many, the top five recipients of QE2 went to European banks. Not the guys at the local VFW. Even with that help, the European banks have a huge number of bad loans. Europe's debt-to-GDP ratio is soaring, while building permits are dropping to zero. The European Union is a loosely affiliated group of basket cases. It is painfully instructive to look at them basket by basket. Let's start with Greece. Put a fork in it. Unemployment exceeds 25%, and youth unemployment exceeds 50%. Recall that violent behavior usually comes from employed youth. They are incapable of waxing philosophically like their ancestors. Several large Greek banks have collapsed, and there weren't that many to start with. Branches are closing at the rate of 2 or 3 a day. Authorities placed restrictions on withdrawals to stem the flow of capital. Indeed, it worked. Hardly a euro will ever flow into the Greek banking system. Hotel California in reverse. The IMF is said to have manhandled Greece, turning their economy into a pile of rubble owing to their austerity policy. As I've said before in a number of different contexts, austerity is not a policy, it is a consequence of bad policy. Nobody should ever lend to the Greeks. They are the perennial world default champions. Greece continues to create ruins. In Spain, the good news is that Spanish debt is registering some pretty low interest rates. The bad news is that those rates reflect a monumental global credit bubble fueled by monetary interventionists of a higher order. Spain has over $1 trillion of debt and has been through a half dozen bailouts in quick succession. Debt service is sucking up 30% of its tax revenues. Spain was forced to borrow from its Social Security reserve to fund pension payments. New Jersey did this too, which put Spain in bad company, I should say. Spain also has a monstrous property bubble with over 800,000 unfilled homes. Rumors of a 47-story office building in which the contractors had forgotten to install elevators are probably a spoof-turned internet legend, but how would you know? One intrepid Canadian debt analyst asked, "Do I really want to blow my brains out in Spain again?" I'm guessing he's not loading up on Spanish debt in his personal account. Heads up. Once Spain's creditors have retrieved as much as possible from bailouts, they will be replaced with bail-ins. In the case of France, S&P just downgraded France's debt, so the French are looking a little fried. The French finance minister, Michel Sapin, said that, quote, "There is a state, but it's totally a bankrupt state." A flight of capital has already left the country amid concerns that France's socialist leader intends to soak the rich and businesses. End of quote. The president of France, François Hollande, likes to think he has things under control, as in, "We can't let the euro fluctuate as the market sees fit." Socialism is likely to live up to expectations. France also happens to have the second business biggest pension deficit, a colossal one at that. How about this priceless gem from Jean-Claude Juncker of Luxembourg? "We all know what to do, we just don't know how to get re-elected after we've done it." Last but not least, in fact maybe even first, Germany. The Germans must be doing well, right? First off, I wouldn't be the first casual observer of history to notice certain geopolitical trends that keep appearing when Germany gets strong. More to the point, however, Germany has its problems. The DAX has rocked, doubling in only 4 years, while economic growth dropped from 4% to 0.7% over this same period. Trend-following hedge funds don't care, but the rest of us probably should. Germany also has the largest pension deficit in all of Europe. Their pensions are less funded than Detroit's. Reunification certainly came at a cost. And as far as the others are concerned, Sweden had 4 days of riots, something utterly unimaginable to yours truly, who lived there for 2.5 years. Ireland held the G8 meeting and created fake storefronts, a Potemkin village, for the visitors. A governor of the Bank of England suggested that, quote, "There is momentum behind the recovery that's coming." End of quote. Yeah, right, like the momentum the car in my parking lot has. Britain has a huge housing bubble. Portugal is broke, unemployed. Cyprus is more than just a country imploding. Cyprus is a beta test for some very bad things and gets its very own basket. Cyprus may eventually become part of a huge story. Cyprus's banking system passed the sham we call bank stress tests and was subsequently found to be insolvent, in no small part owing to pressure on Cypriot banks to buy Greek debt to bail out the Greeks. Enter the bail-in, a euphemism that describes a bail-out of a bank using taxpayers' deposits to avoid burdening tax taxpayers. Excuse me? The haircut to depositors throughout the island kingdom was said to be 10%, a decimation in the purest sense. It might also be referred to as an ice fora, an emergency tax invented in 5th century BC Greece. The banking system was in complete lockdown. Emergency parliamentary sessions were scheduled and cancelled. The peasants were unhappy. This was bewildering for the head of the central bank named Panikos. No nickname needed there. Soon stories began to leak out that the master plan was to clip $60 billion from Russian oligarchs using the shady Cypriot banking system for nefarious purposes. The Cypriot banking system is actually quite transparent. Literally, so now that the banks have been vacated, leaving see-through buildings, we discovered, however, that the Russian oligarchs had gotten wind of the bail-in the previous week and emptied their accounts. Those that did not were able to do so at their leisure through the London offices of Cypriot banks, which were conveniently kept open. The president of Cyprus and his friends also exited. Can you blame them? Soon the reported bail-in rose to 20%, 50%, and then urban legend levels of 90%. Now that is an expensive and indiscriminate haircut, especially for depositors in some banks that were not insolvent. The details probably don't matter to non-Cypriots. Once the dust is settled, Cypriots imposed capital controls to stem the flow out of the country by slamming the bank door. And if you're wondering why Cypriot politicians would let the country get looted, well, politicians are fungible and the going price for any politician never exceeds 6 digits, whereas the looting was on an 11-digit scale. Probes into the carnage began, but then terminated owing to insufficient data. All right, ladies and gentlemen, let's take another break, and I'll be right back. Well, we're running out of time here, so let's just have a very quick glimpse at the rest of the world. Asia, where I live, surprise, surprise, is clearly of profound importance going forward. I can imagine having a lot more to say in some future year in review, but it feels like Asia is in a holding pattern with troubles in the queue waiting to make headlines. A China-Japan or North Korea-South Korea military conflict could bring on the fireworks. The Fukushima nuke story continues to smolder, but sometimes I have to wonder how much is cheap shot fear-mongering. Whenever they trundle out Arne Gundersen, who seems to be the only world expert in nuclear-based tsunamis on the planet, I wince and shudder. China watchers, I respect, are both wildly bullish, as in Stephen Roach, and wildly bearish, as in Jim Chanos. I suspect both bulls and bears are right at some level. Credit and real estate bubbles portend a crisis, and the authorities are terrified of the response by the citizenry. If you recognized the China growth story 15 years ago and dumped your money into the Fidelity China Region Fund, you would have beaten the S&P, but your annual compounded return would have been only 5%. This is disappointing for a miraculous growth story, especially if the downside risk is large. A horde of investors is focusing specifically on Mongolia, but their economy is in its infancy, and it doesn't interest me yet. I will, however, put in 2 cents on Japan. It's little wonder they make good cars. They will also likely be market leader in cluster trucks. Japan has truly massive demographic problems. As noted earlier, but worthy of reiteration, estimates are that in 20 years, Japan will have one worker providing all the goods and services for four people. Neither Abenomics nor the Yakuza are going to change that but ugly picture. Kyle Bass is always giving must-see talks on Japan's mathematically impossible recovery. Even the major brokerages follow this plot line. It seems to have attained truism status for at least some pundits that rising interest rates in the JGBs will destroy Japan's currency, markets, and economy, and interest rates will rise someday. The Bank of Japan, like central banks around the globe, is determined to print around over or through this problem. Last time Japan tried to inflate its way out of debt was the 1930s. It led to hyperinflation, assassination of the Prime Minister, and to its part in World War II. The most direct solution to demography was provided by Japanese Finance Minister Taro Aso, who suggested that the elderly should, quote-unquote, hurry up and die, rather than drain the resources of the government. Well, they'd better hurry up, because the Japanese government is currently borrowing half of its federal budget every year. My dark horse winner for the 21st century is Russia. They have land and resources. All they have to do is straighten out their political system. Moscow is said to have the largest number of billionaires of any city in the world, but every one of them stole the wealth they acquired, which suggests finance and banking will be growth industries. I have little to say about or interest in South America. Brazil is the lead-off batter for the BRICS, but recently started fanning strikes. Argentina, once viewed as the Western Hemisphere's rising superpower, is now what Henry Kissinger referred to as a dagger aimed at the heart of Antarctica. And then there's Africa. I hear rumblings that sub-Saharan Africa is a future growth region. This is garbage analysis. Read Hernando de Soto's The Mystery of Capital. Africa has no ports, no inland waterways, no property laws, weak educational systems, more AIDS than any region in the world, a large machete-toting populace, and numerous oppressive dictators. I don't think any quantity of Bill Gates' help will dent Africa's problems. In short, Africa is a long way past my investing horizon. I do talk a lot about the media on my regular shows, so I won't take much time here, but I do think that a comment from Brett Ahrens of the Wall Street Journal might be in order here. Quote, "It's become a cliche these days to say you don't trust the media, but you know what? You're right not to do so. The problems aren't as bad as they appear. They are much, much worse." End of quote. In the ultimate irony, the media was in the news this year. Of course, there were the little things like Charles Payne buying stocks before touting them on Fox News. Chicago algo traders who were beating the speed of light in trading appeared to get their advance info on the Fed minutes from sequestered prostitutes posing as reporters. There were some really big stories. The biggest, of course, was the Edward Snowden leaks and battles over what defines a legitimate member of the media. I won't discuss this here because it comprises a major part of my final piece on civil liberties, but there were other media-centric scandals, such as the Bloomberg reporters who were snooping on traders using the famous Bloomberg terminals. Traders were baffled by how they were able to do this. The snooping was detected when a Bloomberg reporter asked about someone who had, quote-unquote, not logged into his terminal in a few weeks. That's a Mike Bloomberg whopper if ever I heard one. Did Bloomberg reporters use a subscription service to monitor the activities of the big banks? not exactly a Chinese wall. Tens of thousands of intercepted text messages give this story a taste of Rupert Murdoch's underhand news collection sources. The University of Michigan confidence numbers, which are popular triggers for algos and high-frequency traders, were being released by Reuters early. Dissemination times depended on where you stood on a tiered pay scale. The earliest notices went to the deep-pocketed banks and brokerages, of course. Academia got a black eye when it was revealed that the University of Michigan was in on the scheme. When New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman told Reuters to cease and desist, he ran into a remarkably remorseless opponent. Reuters defended their private service and reserved the right to allocate data as they saw fit. This was actually not a bad argument, but Reuters terminated the practice, at least until the furore dies down. I came across this, which I felt was apt and appropriate for our little discussion today. Quote, "These media shills are like fools. They've broken old media rules. They don't apply heat, but praise the elite to help them abscond with our jewels." Time to hone in on the banks, the bankers and finance. Quite a year, really, wasn't it? 2013 seems like an off year for banking crimes. Of course, there was a steady stream of behavior that makes you want to lynch a bunch of them, but we witnessed volumes of follow-throughs of old scandals and really very few new ones, at least new colorful ones. J.P. Morgan Chase was the first major focus of the DOJ's catch and release program, rendering this syndicate the biggest headline grabber of the year. The sheer magnitude of J.P. Morgan's trouble was foreshadowed by a $28 billion slush fund set aside for legal problems. For weeks at a time, you couldn't click Zero Hedge without seeing a new charge. Gretchen Morgenson and Bill Moyers suggested that the J.P. Morgan Board of Directors needed stronger oversight, possibly removing oversight powers from the chairman of the board, Jamie Dimon. Yes, that would be the same Jamie Dimon who is J.P. Morgan's CEO in desperate need of oversight. The idea that Dimon would be removed from the board of J.P. Morgan sent CNBC's Maria Bartiromo heels up again in his defense. Lehman creditors sued J.P. Morgan because the London whale, Bruno Ixil, mismarked positions that led to an epic and apparently rather invalid $8.6 billion margin call in 2009. The most senior trader suggested that his group, quote, stop reporting losses until there was a market-moving event that could easily explain the losses, end of quote. No wonder bad news comes in clusters. The chief risk officer promoted fibbing about these trades, failing to grasp that a risk officer is there to mitigate risks. J.P. Morgan discovered that some of the attacks against the whales losing trades were coming from within J.P. Morgan itself, a form of autoimmune disease. The former CEO of a major banking subsidiary observed that he discovered traders, quote-unquote, buying our own shit. TBTF means too big to function, I guess. J.P. Morgan eventually threw a couple of expendable employees under the bus to clean up the whale scandal, but at minimal inconvenience. Obviously, they were just legions of honest mistakes, needing only an apology. But the Department of Justice insisted J.P. Morgan accept guilt by publicly declaring, "My bad." J.P. Morgan had to ante up some serious bucks for making Jefferson County, Alabama, squeal like a pig, owing to kinky derivatives deals that sent them into insolvency. the robo-signing fine came due this year. Good news. The dozen or more fraudulent Linda Green signatures at the centre of the robo-signing controversy have all been indemnified. There is no mess that is too big to clean up with a stroke of a pen. Whether it's the ethanol derivatives or the energy markets in general, the Enron-esque manipulation of commodity prices by J.P. Morgan continues. J.P. Morgan has not yet rigged the aluminum and copper markets because Goldman Sachs controls those along with pornography, which they promptly sold once they got caught. J.P. Morgan's rigathon extended into the forex markets, but they've seen the error of their ways. They've now moved the most dubious deals offshore, away from the long arm of the aggressive U.S. regulators. This is purely prophylactic. There are no regulators fitting that description. J.P. Morgan's really big problems came in the form of gargantuan fines for their role in mortgage-backed securities. I must admit to being sympathetic to their supporters' claims, led by the usual CNBC suspect Maria Bartiromo, that these problems were baggage from Countrywide and Washington Mutual that J.P. Morgan absconded with at steep discounts. Maybe the $28 billion is just a clawback of the $30 billion of Fed backing they garnered during the forced purchase of Bear Stearns. Tax deductibility of the penalties added salve to the wounds of all but 100 million taxpayers. Many summaries of this criminal behavior have been penned, all of which have led to the expected number of prosecutions, zero. A few generic deeds of the banks are also worthy of comment. 15 states banned payday lenders, prompting the banks to move the funding for them offshore. 6 Bank of America employees accused Bank of America of shepherding homeowners into foreclosure rather than through the Fed-assisted mortgage restructuring. For the record, I think Bank of America had this one right, nevertheless. The Bank of America whistleblowers should probably think about getting remote starters for their cars. Whistleblowing has become a dangerous career path. The truth no longer protects you from retribution. I'll talk much more about this during the final section of this talk. What else? Oh, yes, we discovered that Bank of America gives bonuses to employees who acquire high-ranking government jobs, showing that the door truly revolves. A clause in his 2006 contract scored big for the new Secretary of the Treasury, Jack Lew, and probably much bigger for Bank of America. This is not surprising, given Lew is in Robert Rubin's orbit. Insider trading in the Heinz acquisition was tracked to Goldman. Goldman's fabulous fab, Fabrice Tour, went on trial, and nobody cared. After years of being called a lunatic, Patrick Byrne of Overstock was exonerated when emails surfaced showing that traders had indeed naked shorted his stock into dust. Naked shorting is illegal. S&P, a banking subsidiary euphemistically called a bond rating agency, defended against charges of fraud in its ratings by correctly arguing that reports put out were mere puffery and not to be believed. That is true, but then they lost. That's an 0-2 ouch. Nomura got caught helping Banca Monte dei Paschi di Siena use derivatives to hide losses. Deutsche Bank used derivatives to cover up derivatives losses. The quadrillion-dollar derivatives market, rich in counterparty risk, seems like the odds-on favorite to destroy the world. But for now, it serves its purpose, as described by the New York Times, and I quote, "Banks use derivatives they create to help clients deceive the public. Other times, they enable the banks to deceive those clients." End of quote. Hank Greenberg and others sued the feds for an unlawful taking when the feds essentially nationalized AIG. I'm taking Greenberg's side. Dave Stockman describes in The Great Defamation how the bulk of AIG was fully cordoned off from the derivatives traders that supposedly would have brought it down. Reams of statutes ensured that AIG would not have been dragged under, providing yet further evidence that the great intervention of 09 was both a colossal breach of capitalism and illegal. In a more general sense, the system should not have been saved in its current highly mutant form. Dean Baker provided a nicely phrased, sarcasm-slathered thank you to Ken Geithner, who has just exited the private sector-sponsored public sector to buy out firm Warburg Pincus via the revolving door. There were tackier exit channels than that, but he will need a good tax accountant nonetheless. Quoting Geithner, "You're going to look like you're giving money to people who were responsible for burning down the economy." End of quote. There is a story that is potentially big and hasn't got much coverage. Most know that Elizabeth Warren isn't a fan of the banks. She has criticized them for getting freebies from the Fed of $85 billion a year. Warren and John McCain have introduced a bill to break up the enormous banks and to bring back Glass-Steagall-like regulations. The untold story is that brilliant credit analyst Chris Whalen criticizes Warren for being off on her numbers, way off on her numbers. He claims that the central banks are actually giving them a monetary reach around of $500 billion annually. Whalen is just not some internet wingnut, or, hey, maybe he is now. In my inevitable comments about the Fed, I'm not going to go through a litany of Fed outrages. I do that enough during the regular shows. What I want to do here is to show how incredibly stupid they are and how they really have no idea what they're doing or even thinking. It's all straight from the hip policy. Truly, truly, ladies and gentlemen, believe me when I say that these people are totally clueless. They are immature children with very big and dangerous toys that they have no idea how to use. The Fed seemed particularly unmoored this year. They have a balance sheet of nearly $4 trillion and growing at $1 trillion a year. We were promised the taper, a reduction in QE, and they seemed determined to do it. But then they went limp. What was that all about? Fed Governor Richard Fisher openly stated that the failure to taper, quote, did not reflect the discussion at the policy setting table, unquote. Well, I guess that's what happens when you put all your heads down to vote. So they're printing $1 trillion a year and they don't know how to stop. But then, when a congressman asked Bernanke if he was printing money, Bernanke responded, "Not literally." The congressman, he should have tried this one. "Is that creating money in some form? Or how about, do we look so friggin' stupid as to not know why you used the term literally and that there is no ink or paper involved?" At least Paul Volcker had the guts to clarify. In the common vernacular, that is termed printing money. Or how about James Bullard of the Fed, who on one day said, "We're manufacturing money out of the blue. The manufacturing monetary basis is off the charts, absolutely off the charts. And believe me, I'm the biggest inflation hawk." And on another day, he said, "We've got low inflation, that's why I'm not worried." Wow. Narayana Kocherlakota of the Minnesota Fed that said that money policy is too tight, whereas Dennis Lockhart, hailing from the Atlanta Fed, says this is an entirely new dimension of monetary easing, both in terms of quantity and quality. End of quote. quality money printing. Mere break. Lockhart expands on this at a later date, noting that, quote, growth of the Fed's balance sheet could have longer-term consequences that are worrisome, end of quote. Lockhart also noted that, quote, we only have a mandate to concern ourselves with the interests of the United States, end of quote, completely ignoring the written record showing that QE2 and more went straight to Europe. John Williams of the San Francisco Fed, in a moment of great clarity, told us that, quote, when house prices fall, people turn much more pessimistic about future house price appreciation, end of quote. He confessed that, quote, asset bubbles are likely to be far more complicated than the simple and elegant rational models we have relied on, end of quote. In other words, the models are too simple, not that elegant, and completely wrong. Greenspan himself was a flawed model. Close to the top of the pile of ridiculous comments was this by Priscilla Roberts of the Richmond Fed, who said, and I quote, the most notorious episode of monetary ease, however, occurred in July and August 1927, when Strong, that was the Fed chairman of the time, though alarmed by the American market's speculative and inflationary tendencies, nonetheless forced through the Federal Reserve System a decrease in the discount rate from 4% to 3%, end of quote. Which, of course, is exactly what they've been doing in recent times. This poor creature doesn't even know what she's saying. In the true spirit of Americans in general, who will criticize anyone for anything except for stupidity, which remains absolutely out of bounds in any discussion, the thinking has it that the entire confused pattern of Fed acts could well be by design. Economist Vince Reinhardt nailed it with some very clever reasoning for how the raw stupidity of these morons was exposed. He argues that in 1994, the Fed pushed for transparency by publishing the FOMC minutes, which promptly showed that the governors all sounded like imbeciles. This soon caused the discussions to become stiff, orchestrated, and altogether useless for real decision-making. The Fed learned to cover up its foibles, a la Breakfast at Bernie's. The Fed would push out their completely incoherent Fed chairman, Greenspan, to babble Fed-speak at Congress. They branded this garbled dialect as a skill, rather than just a bloviating incoherent Fed chair working from flawed models. With Greenspan's departure, the Fed desperately needed a replacement for the departed incoherence. The Fed didn't have to worry. A series of seemingly thoughtful statements from the individual governors, when put together, made no sense whatsoever. The Fed is nothing more than a bunch of sub-average IQ types who are collectively an incoherent committee of academic ignoramuses. Bernanke's ghastly policy errors have achieved nothing of economic or any social value, and he departs the Fed in a few days in total intellectual shame. Well, the next task was to do a little Yellen rehab and start deifying her in earnest. You see, they must deify the FOMC chair because the banks require a Fed chair with the moral authority to do anything the banking system wants, no matter how destructive it may be to the rest of us. The Fed chair cannot be questioned. Fed Governor Richard Fisher leads off. She's wrong on policy, but she's a darn good, decent, wonderful person. Whoa, can't we do a little better than that, Dickie boy? The puff pieces by seasoned journalists on the White House payroll began in earnest. Soon, Yellen was brilliant and was the star who prevented the Panic of 2010, which is why nobody ever heard of the Panic of 2010. She became the only Fed governor to have seen the crisis coming and to call it right. If she did see it and call it, she would certainly be the only one, but she didn't. Peter Schiff dissembled that myth by ploughing through her speeches and showing that she was as clueless as any of them. Now, just for fun, let's list a few of the more ridiculous things people said this year, starting with Joe Biden, who said, "I'm proud to be President of the United States." CNBC's most watched sequence occurred when Bill Ackman and Carl Icahn brawled during prime time. It was ostensibly about Herbalife, Ackman being short and Icahn long, but it more looked like two guys having a pissing match writing epithets in the snow. I'm sure Ackman has some bootlegger qualities, but it would be hard to root for Icahn. One of his peers refuses to even eat a meal with him. In any event, Ackman soon found that many of his positions, long or short, mysteriously turned hard south. Icahn licked Ackman, and Ackman licked wounds. I think the message is, do not piss off a mean bastard's worth a gazillion dollars while other billionaires stand around placing huge bets on the fight. As an aside, Herbalife seems poised for a plummet now that Ackman and weak-knuckled imitators got squeezed out. Ackman gives Herbalife a one-year life expectancy, ironic for a health supplement company. Steve Cohen of SAC Capital got beaten up pretty fierce this year. He's not going to jail, of course. But District Attorney Preet Bharara appears to have extracted some serious Bitcoin out of him, more than $1 billion, as well as put a stake in SAC's heart. Patrick Byrne, still smarting from the pain of naked short sellers beating down Overstock.com, maybe even Steve Cohen, took out a full-page ad to mock him, and I quote, "Shooting SAC Capital dead and throwing all of its employees into the street is civilization scraping some dog shit off its shoe." End of quote. Catchy prose, huh, Patrick? Citigroup was fined $30 million for sending Cohen et al. Insider information. The fine was kept low, given Citi is already a ward of the state. It would appear that Stevie didn't follow Corzine's lead and bundle campaign donations for the guy calling the shots. Jeff Sachs suggests that the bundling did get him some serious slack. I, by the way, think New York District Attorney Preet Bharara is or will be a bootlegger too. He went to a few too many hedge fund conferences. Politically ambitious New York district attorneys pissing off the richest guys in New York have always struck me as paradoxical. My crystal ball sees a political career for Preet as early as 2016. I wonder who's funding that campaign. Well, Greenspan, no longer in the central banker category, drew scorn for his new book entitled "The Sap in Purgatory, Risk, Human Screw-Ups, and the Future of Forecasting Without a Clue," or something like that. Let's just say that everybody agreed that he has overstayed his welcome. Bill Fleckenstein, hedge fund manager, and co-author of Greenspan's Bubbles, summed up his own views succinctly. "Lock me in a room with that scumbag." A few others get comments in rapid fire. David Tepper has grown fond of the limelight. He waxed bullish on CNBC while contemporaneously liquidating some large positions. Maybe he was rebalancing. Al Gore sold his small network to global warming Al Jazeera. There's something odd about that one. Greg Mankiw defended the 1%. I do too, if we're talking about the titles of industry who build nations, but that was not Greg's slant. He declared he would not respond to his critics. Bad idea. And then the link went dead. But not before the diatribes made it to press. Steve Schwartzman of Blackstone denounced raising the 15% taxes on much of their income by suggesting, "It's a war. It's like when Hitler invaded Poland in 1939. Frankly, involving Hitler to win a debate is covered by Godwin's law, which has it that as an online discussion grows longer, the probability of a comparison involving Hitler or the Nazis approaches one." End of quote. Steve Ratner admitted to directing funding of some GM pension plans and not others during their bailout and restructuring. His image rehab is taking a little longer than he had hoped. AIG's CEO Bob Den Mosch stepped in again when he said that outrage over banker bonuses was intended to stir public anger, to get everybody out there with their pitchforks and their hangman nooses and all that, sort of like what we did in the Deep South. And I think it was just as bad and just as wrong. End of quote. Godwin's Law 101 covers civil rights analogues. How about this priceless admission from Andrew Mason, CEO of Groupon? Quote, "After 4.5 intense and wonderful years as CEO of Groupon, I've decided that I'd like to spend more time with my family. Just kidding, I was fired today. If you're wondering why, you haven't been paying attention." All right, ladies and gentlemen, let's take this opportunity to take yet another break. And now we come to the priceless dicta of Paul Krugman, the idiot economist beloved by all media. So here's Paul Krugperson on good fiat currencies. "When they created the euro, they created a thing like the gold standard. And on bad fiat currencies? I think forming the euro was a mistake, but it's a very different thing to say it should never have been done." Other gems of nonsense. "People talk about waste, fraud, and abuse. There isn't a whole lot of that in the US government, except in defense." And then there's this. "We should have been able to get all the relevant parties in a room and say, look, this inflation has to stop. You workers, reduce your wage demands. You businesses, cancel your price increases. And for our part, we agree to stop printing money so the whole thing is over. That way, you get price stability without the recession." That's talking about the 1970s. Or how about this? "Higher personal savings is really bad for the economy." Oh, thanks, Paul. Or this. "Stuff that's now being called currency wars is almost surely a net plus for the world economy." Here's Paul Krugman on beggar thy neighbor policies. I just love this one. "European economy works. It grows. It's as dynamic, all in all, as our own." Well, that's fun, isn't it? By 2000 or so, it'll become clear that the internet's impact on the economy has been no greater than the fax machines. That's Paul Krugman in 1998 on passing fads. "As the rate of technological change in computing slows, the number of jobs for IT specialists will decelerate." Oops. There's Paul Krugman slipping up and making a valid point. "I'm terrified about what will happen to interest rates once financial markets wake up to the implications of skyrocketing budget deficits." And finally, "Thrift leads to lower investment. Wage cuts reduce employment. Even higher productivity can be a bad thing. And the broken windows fallacy ceases to be a fallacy." That's Paul Krugman on the destructive power of saving and productivity. Well, moving on to some of the more enlightened stuff, here's one I quoted quite recently, actually, from Andrew Hazar, a former Morgan Stanley administrator of QE1. An astonishing confession and a must-read in its entirety. And I quote, "I'm sorry, America. As a former federal Federal Reserve official, I was responsible for executing the centerpiece program of the Fed's first plunge into the bond-buying experiment known as quantitative easing. The central bank continues to spin QE as a tool for helping Main Street. But I've come to recognize the program for what it really is, the greatest backdoor Wall Street bailout of all time. We were working feverishly to preserve the impression that the Fed knew what it was doing. You'd think the Fed would have finally stopped to question the wisdom of QE. The Fed announced a new round of bond buying. Wolfgang Schäuble immediately called the decision clueless. That was when I realized the Fed had lost any remaining ability to think independently from Wall Street. The Fed is at the center of that dysfunction. It has allowed QE to become Wall Street's new too-big-to-fail policy. End of quote. Unbelievable, ladies and gentlemen. Seldom has one heard the voice of truth so eloquently expressed. In stark contrast to whatever else is being said by the powers that be. Hazar actually ran the first QE1 program. He ran it. Incredible, huh? Then there's this from Ken Langone, founder of Home Depot. Quote, "You've got to look behind the markets to see what is happening. We don't know when the storm is going to hit, but it has to happen. When you look at our debt to GDP, eventually you reach a point where there is no turning back. This is a rape of unborn children. It's generational theft of an enormous magnitude." End of quote. Quite sobering, I should say. From Dylan Rattigan, we have this year's absolute best rant, during which he said, "This is a mathematical fact. Tens of trillions of dollars is being extracted from the United States of America." If we have time at the end of the show, I will ask Jassel, our engineer, to play you the entire rant. I did so a few months ago, but it bears listening to a second time. He subsequently left broadcasting to chase interests in hydroponic farming. From Brooksley Bourne, former head of the Commodity Futures and Trading Commission, we get this. "Big banks should be tasked with the job of deciding how best to split themselves up." End of quote. Bourne attempted to bring derivatives trading under regulation in the late 90s, but was mugged by the Committee to Destroy the World, i.e. Summers, Greenspan and Rubin, in congressional hearings. Frontline did a brilliant must-see expose on this fateful moment in history. Joseph Baratta, head of Blackstone's private equity group, had this to say, "We are in the middle of an epic credit bubble, in my opinion, the likes of which I haven't seen in my career in private equity." End of quote. Interesting candor, given that these guys live and die by a leveraged financial system. Elizabeth Warren, now a senator, asked this interesting question, without getting a coherent reply, of course. "Tell me about the last few times you have taken the big Wall Street banks all the way through to trial. My question is, when did you take them to trial?" Michael Lewis, author of Moneyball, The Big Short, and Liar Pokers, said this, "Goldman has to be changed from the outside. The market could do it, but the government is standing in the way." David Einhorn, CEO of Greenlight Capital, asked three really penetrating questions. One, how much does QE contribute to the growing inequality of wealth in this country, and what are the risks this creates? Two, how much systemic risk does the Fed create by becoming what Warren Buffett termed the greatest hedge fund in history? And three, how might the Fed's expanded balance sheet and its failure to even begin to normalize monetary policy 4 years into the recovery limit its flexibility to deal with the next recession or crisis? Barry Sternlicht, founder of Starwood Capital Group, offered us this. The Fed is really playing a dangerous game. I want them to stop. They should knock this off. This is bad. This is a heroin addiction. This is not good. This is not smart. End of quote. Let's look at a couple of government hacks to see where their loyalties lie. Eric Holder. Yes, he whose feckless pursuit of criminal elements, his dogged determination to protect them, inspired one big heck of a job, Eric, out of me already last year. For a guy who started adulthood as a militant campus radical, he sure morphed into a cog within that which he opposed. He left open the option on drone strikes against American citizens, faked statistics on fraud cases brought to trial, but only by a factor of five, prosecuted a government official in a bribery case, but left the deep-pocketed banker unscathed, illegally recused himself from a case without providing a reason, failed to respond to a child pornography ring of government employees, and admitted that some banks are too big to risk prosecution. Holder signed off on a subpoena that went after a Fox News reporter's private emails calling the target a possible unindicted co-conspirator. 50 congressmen signed a letter asking for Holder's demotion to unemployed. Holder's really more of a placeholder, but he's still employed. Then we come to Lanny Brewer. We got some excitement when Frontline aired the expose entitled The Untouchables. It is a must-see. Assistant Attorney General Larry Brewer argued that, quote, I don't accept for one moment that you are all finding whistleblowers that we are not, end of quote. The plot thickened at precisely the moment when the highly expendable Brewer admitted that some banks were too risky to prosecute, and I quote, if I bring a case against Institution A, and as a result of bringing that case there's some huge economic effect, it's a factor we need to know and understand, end of quote. And that was Lanny Brewer, Assistant Attorney General, on Frontline. Well, there was indeed a ripple effect, because the following Monday, Lanny announced that he would be spending more time with his family. He then promptly took a job at Covington and Burling, a former employer of Eric Holder, no less, for an estimated $4 million a year, establishing the market price of family time. Lois Lerner was a mild-mannered IRS commissioner who found herself sitting in the hot seat when it was discovered that IRS agents had targeted right-wing organizations as conspiracy theorists in the Tea Party had been alleging. What started as a rogue agent was soon working its way toward the White House. A Freedom of Information Act suit retrieved records showing 157 visits by Ms. Lerner to the White House, which is probably close to Cheney's account when he was acting president. She made the Football Hall of Fame for biggest fumble when, as commissioner of the IRS, she admitted under gentle questioning by Congress, I am not very good at math. She tried to plead the fifth, but then said something that negated her plea. Whoops! It's under the bus for you, lady. Lerner went on administrative leave in May. And the epilogue? It is claimed that the Tea Party still has tax problems. The irony of it all is that the tax exemption of many political organizations should probably be questioned. The really twisted part is that some suspect that Obama released the IRS scandal to douse the flames of the Benghazi scandal. If all this were not funny enough, there was an IRS micro-scandal in which IRS employees partied their asses off on taxpayers' dime and, when questioned, announced that they had lost their receipts. You just can't make this stuff up. How about Mary Jo White, who, as previous SEC head, took the revolving door to high income at Promontory Financial Group? The new head of the SEC, Mary Jo, M. Jo White, took her place. Technically, MJO should not be in this section at all, but I'm taking out a put option on her stay at the SEC. Joe Saluzzi and Sal Amack, Wall Street veterans and authors of Broken Markets, wrote an open letter to her begging her to unbreak the markets. Their need to send such a letter is telling. Chris Whalen seems to like her, whereas Matt Taibbi makes the case she will be a Wall Street darling. Bloomberg's Jonathan Weil paints a grisly picture of White's conflict of interest with payout to MJO by her current White Shoe law firm that will continue in perpetuity. One of her earliest policy moves was to authorize hedge funds to advertise. The Supreme Court already dealt with that one in the context of lawyers, but it will almost certainly produce the sequel to Boiler Room. Despite the usual wave of puff pieces of little value that preceded her first day of work, the New York Times editorial staff appears to have planted their flag in the camp of doubters. And now I suppose we have to turn our attention to Barack Obama himself. Please remember, ladies and gentlemen, no politics at all are involved in this. Left, right, up or down, east, west, north, south, it's all the same to me. I don't like politics and I don't like politicians, so you won't get a rise out of me on any score there too. To start with, can anyone explain why Obama might have said on Jay Leno, "We don't have a domestic spy program"? Despite his oratory skills and affability, his roots in the Chicago School of Politics lead me to suggest that at the outset that he was not pristine. This year ushered in some truly disturbing stuff, however, causing his approval ratings to drop below those of a crack-headed mayor of Toronto. Those looking for hope and change seemed to get neither. Liberal Democrats, including Michael Moore, Matt Damon, Bill Ayers, Cornell West, and the ACLU, turned on him. Even Art Fleischer, White House press secretary for George Bush, said, "I think of this as President Bush's fourth term." The year started out generically with the Benghazi fiasco, in which Obama boned it badly by not providing support to an embassy. Lives were lost, and then he tried to cover it up. That's standard fare for a president these days, but the tide just kept rising and sands kept shifting. The IRS gate had White House fingerprints all over it. The journalist phone hacking scandal was nasty but short-lived. The White House defended hoovering up Verizon phone records to fight terrorism. Catch that, Hoover, double entendre? This story got some serious legs when a high school graduate, aficionado of fine strippers, and NSA analyst Edward Snowden entered the scene. The Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, ironically turned into a third trimester abortion. A website that could have been put together by a couple of kids from Palo Alto High was contracted out to one of Michelle Obama's Princeton contemporaries for $500 million and appears to have thrown the entire healthcare system into a tailspin. The key promise, "You didn't have to participate if you didn't want to," turned out to be a very big lie. Now we have millions without healthcare or with significantly more pricey healthcare. The head of it all, Kathleen Sebelius, still has her job. A book by Jeremy Scahill entitled Dirty Wars describes the modern U.S. war machine. Scahill, no right-wing hack by any measure, said that Obama was statistically more hawkish than George Bush the Younger in every category. Obama promised to get rid of Guantanamo, which many inferred did not mean setting up a new gulag elsewhere, but it never came to pass. We all know more than is good for us about the NDAA, the Snowden affair, and drone warfare. And then there's Syria. In an odd parallel with the HBO series Newsroom, in which U.S. troops supposedly used sarin gas, Bashar al-Assad reputedly used it against the Syrians. Assad had every weapon pointed at his head, so you would not have predicted that. Subsequent evidence surfaced that it was not his call or even Assad's troops. Nevertheless, Obama had his terrible hankering to bomb Syria for reasons we will never be privy to, although natural gas may be involved. But he realized he was in political trouble. Kerry played into his hands with an off-cuff observation that America would hold off if Assad promised to hand over his chemical weapons, which Kerry admitted would never happen, and announcing that America would launch a quote-unquote unbelievably small and limited effort to punish the Assad regime. Nothing says I love you like a cruise missile. Then Vladimir Putin latched onto Kerry's statement with some diplomatic moves that took Kerry at his word, not at all what Kerry had intended. Putin had this to say to the New York Times, quote, "The United Nations founders understood that decisions affecting war and peace should happen only by consensus. The profound wisdom of this has underpinned the stability of international relations for decades. No one doubts that poison gas was used in Syria, but there is every reason to believe it was not used by the Syrian army, but by opposition forces to provoke intervention by their powerful foreign patrons." End of quote. Turns out he was almost certainly correct, basis information available to us in the last few days. Fancy that. America almost killed a pile of Syrians trying to prevent them from killing another pile of Syrians. It sure seemed like bombing Syria was a really stupid idea. Oh, Lord, did I use that word stupid again? Obama's Wall Street supporters were constantly embarrassing him with their looting and pillaging. I think his colossal failure, his true colossal failure as president, will prove to be his unwillingness to rein in the banking sector when a window opened and opportunity knocked in 2009. Matt Taibbi referred to Obama as the quote-unquote architect of too big to fail, although that seems like too much credit. He did, however, choose to save his top fundraiser, John Corzine, all the banks and anybody else of wealth and power. I am strangely optimistic that he will be offered another crisis to justify reining them in as the market decides to test Yellen's resolve. He signed a few dubious bills as well, including one that protects Monsanto against all the tort actions pertaining to genetically modified organisms, or GMOs, another that allows Congress to avoid disclosing their financial holdings, and one that facilitates prosecution of whistleblowers. He's been beating on the media with a rolled-up copy of the Constitution, threatening, of all people, Bob Woodward. His administration ducked FOIA requests about the seemingly dubious Bin Laden raid by moving files to the CIA, which they then dealt with using standard embassy methods. I come now to perhaps the most important part of all to round out this presentation, the frightening disappearance of civil liberties from your country. A couple of quotes would help to put some focus on this, from Thomas Sowell. "It is hard to imagine a more stupid or more dangerous way of making decisions than by putting those decisions in the hands of people who pay no price for being wrong." And then from Aristotle, who said, "Tyrants preserve themselves by sowing fear and mistrust among the citizens, by means of spies, by distracting them with foreign wars, by eliminating men of spirit who might lead a revolution, by humbling the people and making them incapable of decisive action." End of quote. So you see, none of this is new. It is simply a disease which has arrived inexorably at your door. And you are going to have to deal with it, ladies and gentlemen. But the sad part is that you won't be able to. They have by now locked the doors to your freedom and thrown away the key. 2013 found America immersed in, quote, "secret programs approved by a secret court, issuing secret court orders based on secret interpretations of the law," as described by one U.S. senator. Take the case of Edward Snowden versus the National Security Agency, as in, "we have nothing to fear if we are not doing anything wrong, right?" Well, ask former Soviet citizens how that worked out. There is a fine line here. It is legitimate to ask where whistleblowing ends and traitorous acts begin. It was an ominous year for whistleblowers, and things seem likely to worsen for them. There was a time when whistleblowers were protected by the truth. Once the whistle had been blown, the storyline moved from whistleblower to the abuser of power. Nowadays, whistleblowers, whether government or corporate, are dealt with severely, apparently to send a message to wannabes that tattling on the powerful is a poor path to a successful career. A New York Fed employee who blew the whistle on Goldman got fired. A Thomson Reuters employee who went to the FBI with information about the early releases of the Michigan confidence data was fired. Aurelia Fedenson, a former State Department Inspector General investigator, shone a light on alleged wrongdoing by U.S. officials around the globe and had law enforcement officers camp out in front of her house. Bradley Manning paid a dear price for his disclosures. The message is still clear. Go to the press and risk spending life in prison. Obama Department of Justice forced reporter Jim Risen to testify against a CIA whistleblower. That CIA spook had some choice descriptions of torture tactics used in prison. The Constitution forbids the domestic use of military troops. The easy workaround is that you militarize the police. Instances of unruly displays of force are picking up. Smartphones catching them more often as well. New Hampshire police bought armored cars to defend against, quote, groups such as sovereign citizens, free staters, and Occupy New Hampshire, end of quote. That would be you, ladies and gentlemen. They caught the Boston bombers. It was a heinous crime that showed us that some things you cannot defend against. In doing so, or rather failing to do so, they initially put Boston under martial law, which did not yield the perpetrator. If you cannot deliver security as promised, at least let's have privacy back. Mandatory drug tests in high school may seem good to some parents, but even minors are granted constitutional protections against illegal search. Mandatory DNA swabs at traffic stops is an idea of dubious merit. A grocer was arrested for depositing too much cash. Cash is a civil liberty, a form of privacy, which should protect ferociously, even if it is a rapidly depreciating asset. So what if drug lords use cash? They also use cars, condoms, and boats. A kid sat in jail for months without trial for poor judgment about what you should post in jest on Facebook. Apparently, using LOL does not undo the speech crime. More than 7,700 people have been arrested protesting the absence of banker arrests. The media's rights are getting trampled on, forcing reporters to take special precautions to protect their sources. Pissing off the media may have been a bad move for the totalitarians, although the media is already under a firm grip. California passed a zero-tolerance DUI law. Do you know how many substances are considered intoxicants and how long they take to completely clear your system? You'd better figure that one out before you drive to work tomorrow morning. It appeared that the DOJ investigated Standard & Poor's for downgrading U.S. debt and not being owned by Warren Buffett. Eminent domain of mortgages, said by some to be an illegal taking, is going to be used in Richmond. Contract law is optional when crony capitalism seems a pie to be divided. Some restaurants are requiring ID to use $100 bills. If I knew of one, I would go there with only $100 bills and no ID. Take it or leave it, folks. It's legal tender, you morons. Facial recognition software is being used in shopping malls to optimize your shopping pleasure, but to me it brings new meaning to Black Friday sales. The Supreme Court, a body of judges who draw scorn but remain in my wait-and-see box, repealed the Voting Rights Act of 1965. I am even less qualified to have an opinion on this one, but it smells odd. They also ruled that remaining silent can and will be used against you in a court of law unless you properly invoke your Fifth Amendment rights. The bad guys will figure out how to do this. Honest people will go into an arrest ignorant of this technicality. Apparently those wussy Guantanamo detainees didn't like the waterboarding every day, spurring them to try to take the final exit with hunger strikes. America force-fed them because there was simply no other way to ensure that they rot in a cell without legal recourse. Michael Lewis resurrected the Sergei Aleknikov case. Sergei did not invoke his Fifth Amendment rights because he thought he could clear up a misunderstanding when he was accused of stealing the Goldman Sachs software used to manipulate markets. He got 97 months in prison for a theft that profited him precisely $0. The conviction was overturned by the United States Courts of Appeals for the Second Circuit. No problem. They arrested him again from a different jurisdiction on different charges. The crime of pissing off Goldman, avoiding the constitutional prohibitions against double jeopardy. He was convicted. All right, ladies and gentlemen, let's have one more promo moment, and then I'll be right back. Well, as to Edward Snowden, everyone except the Amish knows that story. What I want to do here is draw your attention to some of the things people have said about him this year. Al Gore. Edward Snowden has revealed evidence of what appears to be crimes against the Constitution of the United States. Dianne Feinstein, liberal Democratic senator from California. I don't look at this as being a whistleblower. I think it's an act of treason. And from Jimmy Carter, America has no functioning democracy at this moment. I think the invasion of privacy has gone too far. Snowden's insights are likely to be useful because they have informed the public. How about this gem from Michael Hayden, former director of the NSA and CIA, implicitly referring to the presidential kill list? I must admit, in my darker moments over the past several months, I'd also thought of nominating Mr. Snowden, but it was for a different list. Then there's this from Wolfgang Schmidt, a former East German Stasi agent. It is the height of naivety to think that, once collected, this information won't be used. Then we have Lindsey Graham, U.S. Senator from South Carolina, lining up behind the hawks with, "I hope we follow Mr. Snowden to the ends of the earth to bring him to justice." Ron Wyden, Senator from Oregon and member of Senate Intelligence Committee, said, "When the American people find out how their government has secretly interpreted the Patriot Act, they will be stunned and they will be angry." Dutch Ruppertsberger, U.S. representative from Maryland, had this helpful comment. "NSA is one of the largest employers in my district, and it works every day to keep us safe." Daniel Ellsberg, the analyst who released the Pentagon Papers, had this. "There has not been in American history a more important leak than Edward Snowden's release of NSA material, and that definitely includes the Pentagon Papers 40 years ago." All right, well, let's move on and discuss the NSA directly. Let's start with a fateful quote by Frank Church, a U.S. senator in 1975. "America's intelligence gathering capability at any time could be turned around on the American people, and no American would have any privacy left. Such is the capability to monitor everything. Telephone conversations, telegrams, it doesn't matter. There would be no place to hide. I know the capacity that there is to make tyranny total in America, and we must see to it that all agencies possess this technology operate within the law and under proper supervision so that we never cross over that abyss. That is the abyss from which there is no return." End of quote. According to David Burden of the New York Times in 1983, quote, "A federal court of appeals recently ruled that the largest and most secretive intelligence agency of the United States, the National Security Agency, may lawfully intercept the overseas communications of Americans, even if it has no reason to believe they are engaged in illegal activities. The ruling, which also allows summaries of these conversations to be sent to the Federal Bureau of Investigation, significantly broadens the already generous authority of the NSA to keep track of American citizens. End of quote. No laws define the limits of the NSA's power. No congressional committee subjects the agency's budget to a systematic, informed, and skeptical review. With unknown billions of federal dollars, the agency purchases the most sophisticated communications and communicative equipment in the world. But truly to comprehend the growing reach of this formidable organization, it is necessary to recall once again how the computers that power the NSA are also gradually changing the lives of Americans, the way they bank, obtain benefits from the government, and communicate with family and friends. Every day, in almost every area of culture and commerce, systems and procedures are being adopted by private companies and organizations, as well as by the nation's security leaders, that make it easier for the NSA to dominate American society should it ever decide such action is necessary. Michael Hayden fessed up that the NSA did not disrupt 54 terror plots, as they had originally claimed to have done, but rather, quote-unquote, one, perhaps two. Director of National Intelligence James Clapper admitted to perjuring himself to Congress about NSA activities, and he was put in charge of the independent investigation into NSA spying. Every major tech company in the world appears to be under NSA control. The CEO of Yahoo, Melissa Meyer, slipped up by describing consequences. If you don't comply, it's treason. Facebook's head of cybersecurity worked for the NSA. The CEO of Lavabit, an encrypted internet provider pressured to participate in NSA data collection, closed his business and destroyed the evidence. Pending prosecutions suggest that shutting down the company was not one of his options. The participation of Verizon, AT&T, Microsoft, Yahoo, Google, Facebook, PalTalk, AOL, Skype, YouTube, and Apple, rewarded with multi-million dollar compensations for their services, makes it clear that every tech company has been infiltrated. So who did the NSA spy on? You, me, our emails, our cell phone calls, Angela Merkel, the participants at the Davos Economic Summits, the United Nations, spouses, girlfriends, anybody who uses a credit card, everybody doing everything. Politicians under surveillance included a young senator from Illinois who became president of the United States. It is not a bold extrapolation to presume that they are still spying on him. So here's where it gets really nasty. The NSA has been feeding information to local law enforcement agencies. NSA is also providing information necessary to cover up the illegality of the search and seizure that put the domestic police forces on the scent. According to Nancy Gertner, Harvard law professor and former federal judge, and I quote, "It sounds like they are phoning up investigations," end of quote. The DEA has been a favorite recipient of NSA-derived information. All those dastardly folks defending the NSA may not be as evil as they sound. They may be very afraid, or at the very least, terminally spineless. What dirt do they have on Graham, Feinstein, Obama? Grow a pair, folks. The ACLU is not spineless. One must assume that the ACLU's communications have been monitored since its formation back in 1920. Michael Hayden refers to the rest of the Snowden supporters as nihilists, anarchists, activists, LUTSEC, anonymous, 20-somethings who haven't talked to the opposite sex in 5 or 6 years. So, it's time to wrap this all up with a few words in conclusion. As far as the markets are concerned, they look broken to me. It's not hard to make the case that state control of the money supply and explicit state control of the price discovery mechanisms elicit behavior that, although seemingly profitable at times, is likely to lead to lousy returns, at least going forward and more likely to a massive and brutal realignment of values, otherwise known as a crash, produced by the consequences of loose monetary policy. I sense that many investors know we are in trouble and are responding in a National Lampoon-esque way by throwing a toga party. Everybody, equity traders, bond traders, forex traders, all seem to me to have one eye on the exit. It is a truism of markets, however, that the party cannot last, and by definition, the exits are not big enough for everybody to leave at once. There will be some serious bag holding. The banking system cannot possibly hold up to another body blow. This year's theme on the wake-up call has been debt. I will be announcing next year's this coming Friday. Debt. Yes, debt. We don't get to avoid the consequences of our high-flying ways, spending more and saving less, any more than an alcoholic gets to regrow a liver. If there is one message I hope I have conveyed in this year's wake-up calls, it is this. By every measure I can find, the debt is burdensome, generational, and coming at us like a force of nature. The entire world is run on a pay-go system in which the Western world flourished while the boomers produced and were compensated with promises. Now we are about to hit the downslope. As far as liberties are concerned, they are under attack by a growing and increasingly onerous state armed with invasive technology. It might not even be some master plan. Try as I might, I am unable to identify the catalyst which started this terrible trend in motion. Government is a living, breathing organism that evolves but is not always benign. George Orwell is looking prophetic. By all means, try to defend yourselves while you can, although, as I have said previously and on so many, many occasions, we have passed the point of no return. Hope is not a strategy. Making plans to depart and create a life in a more benign environment is. Words do not do justice to the extent of my feeling that this is your only hope. At least, ladies and gentlemen, if you do not do so, you will never be able to say you were not warned. And I'm afraid that will hurt badly. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that just about does it for my presentation to you today. I would love to hear from some of you if you have any comments or ideas and would like to call in. We have about, 10 minutes left, so the lines are open if you'd like to join in. And in the meantime, I thought I would ask Jassel to play you once again that great rant I described earlier from Dylan Rattigan just before he left broadcasting for good. He is truly inspired, and the pathetic bleatings of the bimbo crowd die away pretty soon after he gets going. It is a classic, and I couldn't be happier to offer you this bonus. The best of the year, in my opinion. So here we go, Dylan Rattigan at large.
I understand that, but
the goal is
you can't
to walk out
say,
a $4 trillion solution, which is basically just a way for the Democrats to avoid dealing with this until 2017. I'm not here to talk about plans to deal with this till 2017. I'm saying we've got a real problem, and I'm tired of Republicans and Democrats who either want Republicans who want to burn the place to the ground, and Democrats, with all due respect, who want to offer a plan that gets it through the their end of their second term of their presidency and then screws me and my kids when it's over. And until we do that, we have to deal with the extraction that is at foot. It is the reason the financial markets are behaving the way they're behaving. That is a mathematical fact. This is not some opinion. This is a mathematical fact. Tens of trillions of dollars are being extracted from the United States of America. Democrats aren't doing it. Republicans are not doing it. An entire integrated system, financial system, trading system, taxing system that was created by both parties over a period of two decades is at work on our entire country right now. And we're sitting here arguing about whether we should do the $4 trillion plan that kicks the can down the road for the president for 2017 or burn the place to the ground. Both of which are reckless, irresponsible, and stupid. And the fact of the matter is, until we actually, and I'm sorry to lose my temper, but I tell you what, I've been coming on TV for 3 years doing this. And the fact of the matter is that there's a refusal on both the Democratic and the Republican side of the aisle to acknowledge the mathematical problem, which is that the United States of America is being extracted. It's being extracted through banking, it's being extracted through trade, and it's being extracted through taxation. And there's not a single politician that has stepped forward, Susan, to deal with this.
But there's only one right now. The leader of the free world, whether you like it or not, the president of the United States is arguably one of the most powerful individuals we have out there.
But
and
Susan,
he's
what you're
president.
Saying is exactly the point that Dylan is making. It's not about one guy. It's about all of them.
No, I actually disagree. I think Dylan's saying it is about one guy.
I would like him to go to the people of the United States of America and say, people of the United States of America, your Congress is bought. Your Congress is incapable of making legislation on health care, banking, trade, or taxes, because if they do it, they will lose their political funding and they won't do it. But I'm the President of the United States, and I won't have a country that is run by a bot Congress. So I'm not going to work with a bot Congress and try to be Mr. Big Guy. I'm working with the bot Congress. I'm going to abandon the bot Congress like Teddy Roosevelt did, and I'm going to go to the people of the United States and I'm going to say, you've got a bot Congress. And until we get rid of the bot Congress, which is Jimmy Williams' constant point, which is get the money out of politics, and until a president says that's the problem and says he's going to fix it, there is no policy that I can possibly see, no matter how brilliant your idea may be, or your idea, or my idea, or her idea, or your idea at home, is. That idea will not happen as long as there's the capacity to basically fire a politician who disagrees with me by taking funding away from him. Is that a fair assessment?
Money and politics is the root of all political evil. It is corruption at its worst. And until we step up and kick that out of the park, it's going to be the same system all
and
the
only election. The president could do that. We're going
to Congress has to do it too. The Congress has to do it too.
But I'll tell you what, how bad does it have to get? How much money has to be extracted? How many things have to be heard?
The brass tacks. Okay, physically, what do you do?
You go and give a speech.
Right now.
You say,
and then what happens tomorrow?
Tomorrow what happens is you begin the process of actually investing in solving the problem. So I come out and I say, how? I create an infrastructure bank with 2% blending immediately. Once I explain to people the problem, once I explain to you have cancer, once you understand how screwed up your trade, tax, and banking policies are, believe me, you will have no issue when I incorporate an infrastructure bank that I fund with repatriated offshore money that I bring in and then use to create 2% direct lending to every business in America. Because when you realize that the banking system is fully corrupt and defrauding us, and I come out and say that, which is what I want my president to do, that at that exact moment I say, you know what, we got a screwed up situation here, people. You all know it, and now what? I'm going to admit it. And as a result, not only have I admitted it, but we're going to begin the process of solving it like grown-ups. They did it in World War II. They did it after the Civil War. They did it in Latin America with the Brady Bonds. We are not seeing it happen now. The panel stays a little more emotional than I anticipated getting at work this afternoon, but what am I going to do?
All right, ladies and gentlemen, well, I hope you enjoyed that. It was quite historic, I feel, for the media. But nevertheless, he's taken his swan song and doubtless is having fun on a farm. But you know, there is no rational economic argument for ever-growing government spending, debt, and taxation. The USA grew out of two things, production and innovation, both of which increased productivity. There is no other source of wealth. Savings must be created from production to provide capital for the system to function. If government spending grows, government taxation must grow and government debt must grow. All interest paid to the foreign owners of America's national debt is lost from the USA entirely forever. Bernanke and the Federal Fraud Reserve steal thousands from seniors by keeping interest rates artificially low. People say things like, we are better off than Greece because our debt is in our own currency. What they fail to add is so that the government can always inflate us out of it by cheating its own people. For 75 years, the United States has engaged in this fraud of passing its bills onto the future. The country never paid for World War II, Vietnam, or Iraq. The great society, the society it just inflated and hoped to grow out of it and devalued your money to let your government spend more, which just had the effect of giving them more power over you. Three times in the 20th century, the country has devalued through massive inflation. 1918 to 22, 1946 and 52, and the 1970s. Pure and simple theft, ladies and gentlemen. And they'll do it to you again. You know, people don't actually think interest rates are going to rise. They want interest rates to rise, so they pretend to themselves and others that they think interest rates are going to rise. This is because they think and hope that their desired rise in interest rates will be counterbalanced by a weaker currency, leading to more GDP growth as U.S. goods become more affordable. And this assumes that the U.S. still makes things that people feel are valuable. Don't just take my word for it. See how when S&P downgraded the U.S., the market doubled down on treasuries, otherwise known as a flight to safety. The people who say they fear a rise in interest rates don't really believe things are going to be as bad as those like myself who are persuaded that things getting as bad as I think they make it utterly impossible for interest rates to rise because nobody will have any money to borrow from the banks, which is motivating the force to push them up. If there is no competition among the banks for borrowing money, the banks cannot raise interest rates, can they? But the unspoken secret is that people just don't feel things are going to get all that bad, which would indeed be a powerful reason for interest rates to rise. It's the same reasoning behind why they think gold will rally, and the same reasoning behind why I think that cannot happen. People don't have the money to just go out and buy gold willy-nilly. Which, by the way, leads to QE itself, which was designed not to help the U.S. economy, but to create artificial demand to buy U.S. treasuries in the downturn, while at the same time lowering interest rates when they shouldn't have been lowered, because the risk premium is higher, not lower. At close to $1 trillion a year, the Fed is now becoming part and parcel of the risk profile of America by over-leveraging themselves as well. The Federal Reserve has already called into question their fairness and their morality by buying up bonds from their most favored friends and refusing to disclose who they are, as well as rigging their own U.S. treasuries. If their QE goes so far as to exceed the U.S. deficit, it will become clear that the monetization scheme is nothing more than the U.S. government running debt and its central bank buying it up, which is completely synthetic and precisely passes for a socialist communist monetary scheme and resembles nothing close to capitalism. At close to $1 trillion a year after the taper, it won't take long for the Federal Reserve's QE to exceed all federal government debt. And they will never have a viable buyer for their rising debt. The longer the Federal Reserve clings on to QE, the less anyone will be willing to finance significantly more U.S. Treasury debt. This quandary will eventually render worthless their money printing schemes to enrich member banks. Many of the conditions that helped the 2008 crisis persist. The top six U.S. banks are larger than they were before the crisis. Through a proposal to restrict leverage has been suggested banks and their holding companies are legally permitted to borrow $97 for every $100 in assets they own. And private pools of capital, including hedge funds, face no leverage restrictions at all. Trillions of dollars are borrowed through the short-term, often overnight repo market. And of course, the skeleton in the cupboard, the true skeleton, credit derivatives, which remain insufficiently regulated. Well, so I guess, ladies and gentlemen, it remains for me to wish you all a very happy, prosperous, successful, and fulfilling year 2014. Have a wonderful celebration on Wednesday, and I will be here on Friday with my view for the future. I thought it would be appropriate to conclude with this short poem by A.E. Housman, which you might find helpful as you reflect on things to come. The thoughts of others were light and fleeting, of lovers meeting, or luck, or fame. Mine were of trouble, and mine were steady, so I was ready when trouble came. See you on Friday. Take care. Bye-bye.